This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you with us on our radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to go to Bismarck and talk about that big river that goes right through the middle of the state and talk about an event coming up that involves Prairie Public and the Lewis and Clark Riverboat. And we're going to talk about all of this with Aaron Barth. He's the executive director of the Fort Abraham Lincoln Foundation. Aaron, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks, Doug. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about your foundation first. What are you the head of?
Right. It all started in May of 2015 when the Fort Abraham Lincoln Foundation, the board of directors, decided to charge me with being the director. So being charged with the director, I was, I suppose, to provide direction to the foundation. And we've been able to really build on and capitalize on all the previous generations and the previous decades of the hard, strong work of the foundation and the community that is, and the state, and even at the National Park Service level that have been able to collaborate and coordinate with the foundation. So the foundation itself started in the early 1980s. And it was really, you know, you do the research on these things, and it's really just an outgrowth, a real grassroots outgrowth of what had been happening from one decade to the next, from one generation to the next, ever since really the Fort Abraham Lincoln, which was one of the many military forts on the continental interior of the United States. You see this with a lot of the military forts. They transition into being either a state park or a national park. This happened, you know, the Fort Abraham Lincoln being decommissioned in the 1890s and then up into the 19-aughts and 19-teens when President Theodore Roosevelt signed over the fort to the state of North Dakota. And then it started, you know, it had really a draw from the locals who understood the fort as I've heard described by a good friend of mine who is a Northern Plains historian, a Lakota historian, as one of the most important forts in the American West, as far as significance goes.
Well, particularly for the Indian Wars and George Custer and all that kind of stuff. Huh?
Yeah, yeah. The famously infamous Lieutenant Colonel George Custer, Brevet General of the Civil War, during the Civil War, a Union cavalry officer. And really a hero. You know, you go and start sniffing around at what Custer did for the Union Army during the Civil War, and he was right there on day three of Gettysburg, thwarting a cavalry charge from Jeb Stuart, helping out there, and, you know, had a pretty remarkable career as a cavalry officer during the Civil War. And we get past the Civil War, post-Civil War, and things, you know, as they turned westward and, you know, to speak direct about it, the country's colonization or the nation state's colonization of the continental interior, which, of course, becomes extremely problematic. These are hard chapters in American history because you have the dislocation or attempted dislocation of all the various tribes and the native nations that were in the continental interior.
Well, his legacy becomes a little less heroic when it gets to the Battle of Little Bighorn and all of that.
Right. Right, yeah. And that, I mean, it's really a, it starts and it picks up and it leaves off right in where our riverboat docks today, right at where the Lewis and Clark riverboat docks. And, you know, you can scratch a surface a little more and you start seeing things like Captain Grant Marsh, who piloted the Far West riverboat. And, of course, before we had the heritage vessel in Bismarck, the Lewis and Clark riverboat, the predecessor to that as far as a heritage steamboat was the namesake of the Far West. But Captain Grant Marsh, he's an interesting dynamic person as well. In 1858, he served with Mark Twain on a riverboat on the Mississippi River. And just stay with me here. I'm a historian by training, so my stories get a little long. But Captain Grant Marsh ends up piloting the Far West riverboat, which supplies Lieutenant Colonel Custer and the 7th Cavalry all the way out to Little Bighorn and the Battle of Greasy Grass, which is, of course, now a National Park Service site as well.
So river boats were important in North Dakota. I mean, we had this ditch here on the eastern side of the state where river boats were plying the Red River for a few years. But Missouri was a major river and probably carried a lot more cargo. We have this event coming up, Aaron, that you know all about. On Saturday the 24th, Prairie Public will host the launch of the Dakota Date Book book aboard your Lewis and Clark riverboat. Besides possibly you, our director of radio, Bill Thomas, will be there. Our news director, Dave Thompson, will be there. Claudia Berg, the director of the North Dakota State Historical Society, will be there. And the book will be there. Dakota Date's book is a favorite of listeners to Prairie Public. And it's often voiced by Merrill Pepcorn, who's, of course, a state senator now, but he used to host this show. And if people want to take part, they can get on that boat on Saturday the 24th for $15. They expect you to be there about 20 minutes before 8 to get on the boat. Take that Missouri River cruise. And if you want to pre-order the book, and it's a beautiful book, coffee table sized, $20 to pre-order the book. It's got illustrations and, of course, all these little snippets of history that we call Dakota Date Book. So that's all available on the 24th, and we're looking forward to lots of friends of Prairie Public and listeners to Dakota Date Book to take part in that adventure on the Missouri. Now, where do they get on the boat?
Yeah, that's another excellent question, Doug. And we are, the physical address is 1700 River Road in Bismarck, North Dakota, 58503. That address is one of several that are seared in my brain.
Yes.
And it's right at the, it's at the Port of Bismarck. So if you're traveling from out of town into town, if you're traveling on Interstate 94, take exit 157. That'll get you onto Divide. And then from Divide Head, you'd head north up to Burnt Boat Drive. And head a take a west, I'll say, on Burnt Boat Drive down towards the river. That'll get you to River Road.
I'll just put it in your phone or your car's GPS.
Yeah.
You're just south of the I-94 bridge.
We're the I-94 bridge straddles us. So you can, you enter the driveway just south of I-94 bridge. You just zip under the bridge and park your car and saunter on over. We'll be waiting for you.
Describe this riverboat to us.
Yeah, the Lewis and Clark riverboat. These were designed by, it's a company that was building these sorts of heritage vessels for decades. Skipperliner is the name of the actual manufacturing company. But ours was built in 1991. And from what I understand, they, it's a little bit before my time. This is what would be the lead up in the late 1980s. So I was either somewhere at Grimsrud Elementary or Hughes Junior High. But in the late 1980s and early 1990s, they had a Bismarck Mandan kind of a contest where they asked kids throughout the school system here, what should we call this riverboat? And it was overwhelming. They decided on Lewis and Clark as a Lewis and Clark riverboat. So it's been this pillar of the community really from day one, where people are enthusiastic about it. It's a fixture in the community. It's when you drive over that last hump, kind of coming in on I-94, you see these pillars, like you see the state capitol, the big vertical tower. You drive across the Missouri River, and from May to September, you will see the Lewis and Clark riverboat docked right there at that underneath that I-94 pass as well. So,
and it's just it's close to Keelboat Park, which is another piece of history.
Absolutely, yeah. We're all about boats, and one generation to the next, right? So, when I was driving up here to the studio to chat with you, Doug, I started thinking of all the various human interaction from not just centuries but through millennia that have happened on this Missouri River, on our stretch of the river, and how it's really a conduit. The Missouri River is the longest river in all of North America. I think just by a couple miles, it beats out the Mississippi River. And I've been at these conferences on the heritage of the river, fur trade conferences, and usually about midway through, somebody will stand up who are big Missouri Riverophiles, right? The lovers of the Missouri River, they'll say the Missouri River is longer than the Mississippi, and everybody will stand up and applaud. And it's, yeah, it's
Well, don't get me started. I'm from Minnesota.
Right, right. Here we go. Here we go. I'm sorry, Doug.
That's all right. So does the riverboat also go under that historic bridge, the BNSF bridge that was built around the time of the Brooklyn Bridge? We talked to some people who are interested in preserving that because they want to build a new railroad bridge there.
Right.
But that one has some real historic significance in its own right.
Yeah, that is another nationally, and you can even say an internationally important, internationally significant piece of infrastructure. It's really the oldest piece of industrial infrastructure on the Northern Plains in North Dakota. It's older than North Dakota statehood. And you're exactly right, Doug. It was built, it's contemporary with the Brooklyn Bridge. It was used the same construction methods that were being used at the same time to finish the Brooklyn Bridge, the caisson method of construction. It's kind of like a bell that was built and sunk to the bottom of the...
It was dangerous for some of the workers because they got the bends.
Absolutely. They got the bends. And there is a copy of one photo that was taken during construction of this. It would have been the Northern Pacific Railroad Bridge at the time. There's a photo in there, and there's about 7 or 8 or 9 individuals staring at the camera. And it's when the caisson was sunk. I'm pretty sure it's when the caisson was sunk, but I stare at that photo, and I wonder how many of those individuals, those laborers, where English was not their native tongue, right?
Mm-hmm.
You would have had a pile of immigrants that would have been the labor crews on these massive, very dangerous infrastructure projects. People died during the construction of these things, right? So it's, you know, the bridge, those bridge piers still stand there. Here's a Minnesota nod to you, Doug. Those, the granite stones of those bridge piers are Minnesota granite. So I'll give you a nod to Minnesota there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's also interesting that this river and Bismarck and Mandan being where they are were the confluence of a lot of history. Talk about the importance of North Dakota's history to the culture of the state and for tourism.
Yeah. You know, when you travel, or when I travel at least, and I know I know I'm a little out there, but I know folks, when you do travel, you're going to places and you're looking for, you know, what makes this place unique? Why is this place unique? And it is exactly those sorts of stories, the history and the heritage, whether it starts with, you know, a lot of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara settlements and village sites up and down the river in central North Dakota. You know, it leads up to, you know, we talk about river traffic, the original, those bull boats. You know, we want to start checking off all the various watercraft that have been on the river. Today, of course, it's a lot of recreational watercraft. There's jet skis and fiberglass boats, and there's sporting and fishing and those sorts of things. But, you know, all the predecessors to that, you have the bull boats, you have the keel boats that you had mentioned earlier, the Lewis and Clark keel boat being one of the famous keel boats. But these were boats that were heading up the river to the various complex of forts to do really a trade of commerce. And so they're pulling all the resources out of the American West, out of the continental interior resources like the beaver pelts, the bear hides and the elk hides and the deer hides. And those are getting shipped back to the population centers, you know, to the then little village of St. Louis. These things go all the way back, you know, make their way to New York City, and they go head overseas over to the European markets and the Russian markets. But it's really an epicenter right here in the center of the continent in central North Dakota. And, you know, it's a couple years ago, for example, I was in New York City and walking around, and I look up, and the New York City Public Library, if you look up at the marquee, it says John Jacob Astor III. It's etched in the top. Well, John Jacob Astor III oversaw the American Fur Company, and an outpost of that American Fur Company, it was Fort Clark State Historic Site, which is just a little bit upriver from where our riverboat docks. I mean, we're a part of, you know, international and national heritage and history in Central North Dakota. And those are the sorts of things that we love telling visitors. And judging by, you know, the wideness of their eyes, visitors love hearing that stuff too.
Well, the Missouri River, back at the time of Fort Abraham Lincoln, was both a way to get from A to B, an important transportation link, and a barrier, because
right.
getting across it was a challenge as well. Let's talk a bit about this capital campaign you've got underway for the Heritage River Landing.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I was just down there earlier this morning. The Heritage River Landing, and that's another one of our river themes. So the architectural design of the Heritage River Landing was inspired by the complex of warehouses, these post and beam warehouses that would have been visible and we would have seen down at the where the boat docks, or a little bit south of where the boat docks, where the today's Burlington Northern or yesteryear's Northern Pacific Railroad Bridge crosses the Missouri River. And today we have the Heritage River Landing, so it's really an outgrowth of the inspiration of those original buildings. Of course, our modern building, we're using as much green technology as we can. We're insulating the thing, so it's not going to be that heritage-y where you're going to be chilled in the winter when you're sitting inside there. There'll be restrooms as well. We have an interactive kiosk that'll show and point to all the heritage recreation resources on the Missouri River in Central North Dakota, and specifically the heritage resources that are part of in partnership with the Northern Plains National Heritage Area, which is one of the 55 national heritage areas in the United States. But the idea as well is to have an actual built piece of infrastructure that connects visitors and residents of North Dakota to this heritage, this very interesting, complex, troubling, diverse heritage of the Missouri River in Central North Dakota, and allowing them to hang out a little bit before, a little bit after. Maybe they use the riverboat, or they don't even have to use the riverboat. They can come and just enjoy and hang out on the river. It'll be a family-centric building and experience as well.
What's the timeline for this project?
The timeline, we will have, some point in the latter part of this year, we'll do some sort of soft opening, but we will wait for the big grand opening for next 2020, April or May of 2020. So more to come on that.
All right. Well, again, we've got a big event for Prairie Public and your foundation and your riverboat. Saturday the 24th, the launch of the Dakota Date Book will be aboard the Lewis and Clark Riverboat. It takes off at 8 o'clock. It's $15 for the boat cruise, $20 to pre-order the book. You can go to prairiepublic.org and find out more information and sign up for the cruise and sign up for the book. Aaron Barth, Executive Director of the Fort Abraham Lincoln Foundation, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Doug, thanks so much for having us.
Coming up, Main Street and Tom Ezern.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 65 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric cooperatives. And by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. History has extra appeal when the story part of it offers a vivid glimpse of times gone by. Historian Tom Ezern tells stories of our past in his Plainsfolk essays, and today's gives us a picture of a time when farm animals lived in town.
The large amount of grain that has been seeded near town will necessitate the herding of stock now running at large. announced at Dickinson Press in 1883. Mr. S. Burnside proposes starting a town herd and will herd all stock at the low rate of $1 per head per week. Well into the middle of the 20th century, prairie townspeople kept milking cows at their residences. They had fresh milk, but at the cost of some public nuisance and personal trouble. To take care of the problem, there arose an institution known as the town herd. Now, this is an arcane detail of community history, I'll grant you, but it tells us something about town life in generations past. The institution of the town herd, too, evolved in ways that resonate with known themes in our historical development. Samuel Burnside, the herdsman referenced by the press in 1883, had a homestead claim not far from the city. In terms familiar to many communities, he offered to collect cows from residences, take them out to the country for the day, and bring them back for milking in the evening. He had to promise to herd the stock because as farmers moved into the country around town, the county activated what was known as the herd law. The herd law invoked what we know today as animal liability. Livestock not properly restrained by fencing or herding and doing mischief to other people's crops made their owners liable for damages. Thus, the passing of the open range offered an opportunity for Mr. Burnside. Problem solved, for the moment. But progress precipitated new expectations. As the open range passed, it was more feasible to improve bovine bloodlines. To hold business, the herdsman in 1892, one Moses Leneville, promised, "Full-blooded Angus bull will be with the herd." So there was good forage and bull service for the cows, but were they given attentive care? By 1906, there was a new sheriff in town, so to speak, in the person of Francis C. Hawley, appointed by the governor as state agent for prevention of cruelty to animals. Mrs. Hawley, who was active in several charitable causes, was less concerned about the cows than about the herdsmen's horses. She issued the following pronouncement. "All persons having in charge of town herds are hereby respectfully requested to regularly and often examine the saddles while on the horses of their herders, and if they find such horses with sore and irritated back or feet, to relieve them at once, and also not to allow the use of spurs. Furthermore, to see that the herders do not recklessly race their horses in pursuit of stock through alleys and elsewhere, over tin cans, old iron, and broken glass, and that their horses are amply rested from the saddle in the middle of the day, so far as practicable. They have no voice to tell their woe." The progressive era had arrived. In 1912, the Dickinson police chief, in peevish terms, announced, "All parties are hereby notified that the town herd has started and there is no excuse for cattle or horses being found in the streets of Dickinson without keepers. It is contrary to the ordinance to allow stock to run at large in the city. Animals found at large would be taken up and their owners fined." No doubt the citizens of Dickinson slept more soundly thereafter. Other towns, too, had their cows and their herdsmen and their issues, a story worth taking up another day.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up on Main Street, horticulturist Ron Smith joins us to talk about late summer lawn and tree care. First, the news.
I think I'm maybe more on a 50-50 confidence level.
That's North Dakota Mineral Resources Director Lynn Helms talking about attracting a petrochemical plant to North Dakota. Helms was part of a delegation from North Dakota that looked at petrochemical facilities in Alberta.
I will say this, that there are at least three petchem processors in Alberta that have all expressed interest in North Dakota. So it's not a one-off. There isn't a single company that we're pursuing that, you know, it's a make or break. There are actually three companies up there. And so that increases the confidence level a great deal.
Another member of that delegation, Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner of Dickinson, said such a plant would help lower the amount of natural gas that is flared in the Bakken. Helms says,
over and above flaring reduction, it would be a true value-added, enormous job-add industry for the state of North Dakota.
The 2019 legislature passed a bill to give petrochemical companies a break on sales tax used for construction materials to build a plant. Delays in replacing Enbridge Energy's Line 3 through northern Minnesota could have an impact on North Dakota crude oil. That line carries Canadian crude from to Superior, Wisconsin. The replacement has been delayed until next year. North Dakota Pipeline Authority Director Justin Kringstedt.
What happens in Canada, what happens in Alberta does have an impact on North Dakota. Any congestion either on that system backing up production and hampering prices on the Canadian side or in the Midwest as a whole will certainly have an impact on North Dakota. So that project moving forward, allowing that expansion, that flow to move more efficiently and safely through that region would certainly have a benefit to North Dakota.
Environmental groups and Minnesota tribes are fighting the pipeline, saying it could cause damage to lakes, rivers, and wild rice beds. Members of the Upper Midwest Power Company group CapX 2020 are about to launch a study of the current power grid and how it can be updated to meet carbon reduction goals. The carbon reduction goals are set to take effect in 2050. Priti Patel is Vice President for Transmission with Great River Energy. She says members of CapEx 2020 have been working toward a carbon-free future, and it has given transmission providers some pause.
And when we think about our existing transmission system that serves North and South Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, we think about future generation, it is fully subscribed and very little capacity is left. And so as we experience this fleet transition where we have power plants that are retiring or suspending, announced to retire, we're also seeing significant penetration of renewables on our system, as well as those that are projected to be on our system in the future, we expect our generation fleet to transition even more in the future. We've just got to be prepared for whatever the collective fleet looks like.
Patel says the study is a critical first step in developing a comprehensive transmission network. She says the study is expected to start by the month's end and be delivered by the first quarter of next year. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and our horticulturist is back with us, Ron Smith, to talk about, you know, late summer stuff.
Ron, yeah, thanks for joining us.
It's great being here, you guys.
What's on the to-do list for
to-do.
Late
yeah.
August?
Okay. The biggest thing we have to concern ourselves is our lawn right now, because the lawn is going through a new growth spurt or growth cycle. If you take the vertical axis and the horizontal axis, with the vertical axis being the growth of the grass, you'll see that going up in the spring, going down during the late weeks or during the month of July, then starting to come back up again in late August and going into September and early October. And so what that's indicating is that the grass is active, putting out new growth in the spring, putting out some new growth now, but it's also storing some carbohydrates into the root system and crown of the plant. And so it's very important that the grass be maintained properly at this time, not neglected because you're tired of mowing it, you know, and everything else. The care you give it right now is going to be very important for it to go ahead and thrive and look good for you next year. So continue to mow high. That's good. If you have another fertilization scheduled, either on your own or through a lawn care company, make sure you have it done between now and the middle of October, around the same time in October. And don't waste any time or money trying to kill off annual weeds that you have there. Annual weeds will be killed by Mother Nature with a good first hard frost that we have. So don't buy any pre-emergent herbicides to take care of annual weeds like crabgrass. If it has crabgrass on the label, that means it's an annual weed killer. Don't bother to do it. If you have perennial weeds in your yard, on your lawn, like dandelion or broadleaf plantain, which are very obvious, or thistle, I hope you don't have any thistle in your lawn. But if you do, this is a good time to go ahead and apply the post-emergent herbicide that would take care of perennial weeds. Because at that point in time, the plant is assimilating nutrients into its crown and root system, And if you apply that herbicide during that time, it'll translate into the crown, the root system, the rhizomes, whatever that plant is made up of, and kill it off. So it's very effective to control perennial weeds now. It's useless to try to control annual weeds at this point in time.
I want to go back to that. This pre-emergent herbicide, is that a market for which there's no purpose? Is that what you're saying?
Well, at this time, everything's in timing, Doug. If it's in the early spring, if we were talking this time in April, early April, late March, that would be the time to do it. And you hear me say, about the time that you see the lilacs in bloom around your property, that's the time that you should probably get started on your annual weed protection. Things like foxtail and crabgrass, you know, they'll be controlled very nicely with this annual pre-emergent herbicide.
But this is not the time of year to do it.
This is not the time, because they've already sprouted, they've already grown. You're wasting time and money to do it. It will not touch those. What the pre-emergent is before the seedlings emerge, they are killed. They're wiped out, so they can't emerge. So it's that simple.
How about for tree care? Are we a little early yet on fall pruning?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Pruning is a very interesting thing to watch, because everybody gets the urge to prune after a long winter, and I think they do that more for exercise than for the benefit of the plant, the trees. The best thing you can do is to try to locate a certified arborist that will come out. If you have an important tree or two, what you call feature trees on your property, that are big, they should be inspected by a certified arborist every year, because you and I don't look up into the tree and say, oh, that's a branch, that's a widowmaker. That one will fall on my roof. That one will fall on my car. That one will fall on my neighbor. So you want to have an arborist that can come out and objectively take a look into the tree and say, well, I could take that branch and that branch and that branch out for you with my extended pole pruners or with my bucket lift for you. They'll make the proper cut. It's not the time of the year. It's a pruning. You prune for a reason, not just for the season. In the spring, we tend to prune for the season. You know, I want to get to it. I need the exercise. The tree shrub should be pruned. Shrubs can recover very nicely, because the rabbits usually prune them down very nicely for us in the late winter. So if we don't take care of the shrubs, 90% of them will come back anyway. They'll pop back up with new growth. But the trees we should pay close attention to, because you can't plant a tree today and get the benefits from it tomorrow. The benefits come as a tree matures.
And there are some trees that are particularly prone to dropping branches?
Yes. Yeah. They're very prone to it, especially bigger branches. Some of the ashes have been doing that, but some of our older trees around the neighborhood, we've seen where with the wind, we've had winds come up, they've come down on some on properties. Some of the other trees that are prone to that are willows, weeping willows, large weeping willows. Some of the any weeping species, like the birch that I have in my front yard, is a tree that drops a lot of small branchlets, which drives my wife crazy. But I have an arborist come out every single fall, take a look up into the tree, and I say, do your thing. I'm concerned about the structural strength of these different branches. And he's done an excellent job for me for the last half dozen years or so.
And that's interesting, too, because you're a horticulturist. Mm-hmm. You know you know your plants and mm-hmm. stuff, but you have a specialist, an arborist, come out and assess the issue.
Yeah, they look at trees all the time, and they could care less about lawns or flowers. So they're looking at trees and learning by mistakes and by other examples that this is a branch that's going to be a problem with this particular species of trees. V-shaped branches that you see there that are V-shaped, narrow crotches like that, are the ones that are most prone to breakage from weights of snow or ice or wind. Mm. U-shaped branches that are more of a U-shape have more structural strength in them. I don't go around looking at trees in that fashion. I look at the tree and say, oh, that's a beautiful architectural thing. If I had to make a living pruning trees, then I would focus myself more on those particular factors.
I can think of another reason, though, to prune trees, and this is perhaps the season because they're fully leafed out and they can literally obstruct important things like intersections
stop
and
signs.
Yeah, yeah, stop signs, right, or oncoming traffic. Which
kids on bicycles,
bicycles,
well,
pedestrians, whatever,
maybe not
whatever.
Quite that high up,
yeah.
But.
So it's one of those things. Yeah, you want to prune for a reason, you know.
And that would be maybe the city forester would
absolutely
be called on that if it's on the boulevard.
Absolutely, I called up the city of Fargo Forester back 20-some years ago, 20, 25 years ago, when I pulled out of an intersection, I looked down. I can't see any cars coming. Oops, there's a car coming right there. So I called him up. I left a voicemail message, and he knew who I was. And this is not a criticism, but come on out and take a look at it.
Yeah.
I could not see the oncoming traffic.
You should call in something that's on city property versus just sort of trusting that they're aware of it?
No, I wouldn't trust that they're aware, but they have a heck of a big job to
okay.
do. And they would appreciate, I'm sure, if they're decent people, and they are decent people, want to have a good reputation for taking good care of the trees that they have here. And so just tell them, you know, this is not a criticism, but I can't look down the street and see any oncoming vehicles or bicycles or even pedestrians because the tree density is so low and so dense.
We have an email question, speaking of trees, from Mike in Minot. He said he planted a Macana ash tree about 16 years ago. And now within this last year, large pieces of bark on the west side of the tree have begun peeling off, revealing a crack in the trunk. And he sent a photo, which we've passed along to you.
Yeah.
What might be the cause of this crack inside the bark? And is there anything to save this ash tree?
Well, this poor tree is not long for this world, unfortunately, and I'm making a drastic diagnosis on this. A couple of things that are wrong, or a couple of things that have happened, is that the tree is planted in the middle of a grass area. There's no barrier around the tree that's going to protect it, a tree trunk, I should say, that's going to protect it. What we need to do is realize where trees grow naturally. They have a mulched area, naturally mulched area of leaf litter, twig litter, everything else around their trunks, and that keeps them healthy and alive. What we as human beings need to do is to realize that when we put a tree in the middle of our lawn, we've got to pull those roots back some and then put a barrier around, a ring around the trunks of these trees, as big around as two people can lock their arms around there, 3 or 4 feet around the trunk of that tree, about 3 or 4 inches thick. And then the other trick is to keep the mulch, the organic mulch, not a rock mulch. Rock mulches are...
Those are heat traps.
Yeah, yeah. You keep about 4 to 6 inches away from the trunk of the tree so you don't have characters that like to get into that mulch, come up and nibble around the base of the tree. This is in part critter damage, and it's also in part mechanical damage from mowers bumping up against the trunk of the tree or the weed whip that does it. So it's a couple of things that you have to watch out for. My suggestion would be to take the poor tree out if they want to try to save it. Go ahead and cut the grass out of there very carefully, going out about 3 or 4 feet from the trunk of the tree. Remove the grass, bring in a mulch, organic mulch, wood chips. Make it about 3 or 4 inches thick. Don't make it a mulch volcano. I've seen that happen, too, where they have, you know, 3 or 4 inches is good. Let's really make it really good, you know.
Right. It's the opposite, right? You want it shallow by the base of the tree and you build
yeah,
out
as
you
go. As you get up close to the trunk, give yourself about that much around the trunk that would be free of any contact with that.
So a couple inches.
The trunk, yeah, itself. Okay. So it works a lot better that way.
Now, this picture shows a tree that looks in real distress. Can a tree come back from that?
Oh, my gosh, yes. In some cases, it would be good if it did the favor of the thing dying, but it will not completely die. And so people want to hang on to it and hang on to it and hang on to it. So the problem is that, oh, boy, We nurse it along. When in the meantime, they could get it out of there, get a fresh tree planted in there, do the right thing with it, and enjoy watching it go ahead and grow and not worrying about it all the time.
Would that crack on the inside, like underneath the bark, be from there being grass just planted too nearby?
No. That's just probably from what I would say critter damage earlier on.
Okay.
And it's just fallen off. I mean, I'd have to talk to them and get some history, some Columbo history on it. that's what I usually do when I get out on a client's call like that. I say, what else has happened here? Get the whole history of it. People don't like to admit that they've done the wrong thing to their trees. Something else has happened.
Yeah.
And so it could be critter damage from snow depth there at certain different heights. So there's a lot of things that could possibly cause that to go ahead and happen. But my recommendation would be get it out of there, go ahead and replant with something that you like, and do everything the correct way.
Well, here's another tree question. Mm-hmm. Our 12-year-old weeping birch tree appears to have died because all the leaves have turned brown. Is it a goner? What do you think caused this?
Well, it sounds pretty drastic. It could be there's a vascular wilt out there that does that, that could kill it off if it's a drastic verticillium wilt. It could also be from borer damage. There's a bronze birch borer that gets into the trees, and they very cleverly, the grub stage of it goes ahead and girdles the trunk of the tree, the various branches of the tree. In this particular case, the 12-year-old tree is a pretty good-sized tree, but it could still have the main trunk girdled by the bronze birch borer larvae, and that could end up with it killing it completely.
You know, I've never heard of the bronze birch borer.
BBB, we call it.
But I've heard of the emerald ash borer. Right. Does every kind of tree have a particular pest?
It's a good question, yeah. Is there nothing that's sacred out there to the tree world? Yes. Unfortunately, every living thing is somebody else's meal. And so it's unfortunate.
So what eats those borer insects? Maybe we just need new birds around here or something. that work?
Well, yeah, they will go after them, but not in sufficient quantity to go ahead and take care of it. And the other thing that happens, too, is you get woodpeckers or sapsuckers that realize, oh, that's a birch or that's a willow, and they have borers in there for me to go ahead and feed on. So you get this looks like riveting all the way around, and then somebody says, that's borer damage. No, that's the sapsucker damage looking for borers. When you start to see indiscriminate holes placed around the tree, that's the borer exiting, okay? That's the exit of the borer. The boring insect, the female, lays her eggs just beneath the bark. That's a little slit. The borer hatches, and it begins its feeding cycle, and it loves the tissue, the cambial tissue underneath, which is the feeding tissue of the plant, the top part of the plant. And so it kills a tree.
Well, now, the emerald ash borer has raised really serious concerns. It's in some cities all around us. It's not in Fargo-Moorhead yet. But should we not be planting birch trees either?
Well, no. It's not that extensive.
Okay. So the bronze birch borer is not as serious an issue as the emerald ash borer.
No, it goes back to our original with that other Mancana ash that we talked about. Mm-hmm. If it's done the right way, the birch will survive. When I first moved here 33 years ago, the tree I planted was this cutleaf weeping birch. And I happened to tell a colleague of mine that I planted this cutleaf weeping birch. He says, that's a stupid tree to plant. It's going to be wiped out by the bronze birch borer, BBB. And I said, no, I planted it the right way. I planted it in a bed, free of any grass, and I've mulched it generously, and I have put in an irrigation system where I can go ahead and keep it moist so it's not going to be in a competitive situation with the turf grass or anything else. We'll see. You know, that's what his attitude was. Well, that was over 3 decades ago, and it's growing beautifully still. So, no, you grow things. You take good care of them, they'll be fine. Unfortunately, with the emerald ash borer, it doesn't care whether the tree's under stress or not. The bronze birch borer will attack trees that are under stress. My tree has been pretty stressless as far as that goes. A green ash, there's no hope. If they're an ash tree,
the
emerald ash borer is going to go after it. The EAB is going to go after it sooner or later.
Before we started recording, Ron, you said that you wanted to talk about mums, and I was surprised to learn that there are some species of mums that are perennials.
Yes. I'll throw in a little hitch there, semi-perennial, because it might depend on the weather condition. And it's not just the middle of the winter cold. It could be in the spring where we get the freeze-thaw cycles. And fortunately for us, we have planted our mums in elevated beds, just slightly elevated beds, not, you know, 3 foot high beds, but just slightly elevated beds. And we brought in some very well-drained soil. So the top part of the mum gets killed off. The crown stays alive underneath the snow. And then you start getting into the shifting winter, spring temperatures. And if the mum starts to break dormancy on a warm spring day, and then it goes back to freezing temperatures and you have water around that due to poor drainage, the frost is still on the ground, you could kill that mum. So if you plant your mums in a well-drained area, the chances are, if they are field-grown mums local from a local nursery, chances are they're going to go ahead and survive if they're planted in a well-drained area.
Why a locally owned nursery versus a big box?
Because they would have them in the field. That's a lot, heck of a lot easier. They start mums as cuttings. They root very easily in a greenhouse. And as soon as they get roots, you get them in a pot. Then you move them outside and plant them outside. Nobody bothers them. Rabbits don't bother them. Knock on wood. and insects don't seem to bother them. They're all very healthy as if they're pampered. And they'll take off and grow very nicely. Then the nursery can go ahead and dig them, bring them in a pot, three or four, a gallon or two size pot. And then you buy them just coming into bud. Bingo. They'll go ahead and flower. Now, they force them sometimes. They can take mums and force them in the greenhouse by controlling the day length. It's one of these day length type situations. So they can go ahead and trick the mum into thinking the days are already short. You need to go ahead and flower, okay, quote unquote. Compared to the mums that are being grown outside, they're going to wait until the days are officially shorter, and then they'll go ahead and bloom for us. So the ones you see now, today, out at the garden center have been forced. There's nothing wrong with that. Absolutely nothing wrong, as long as they were field-grown mums and you plant them in a well-drained spot.
So when I went to the nursery
garden center
a couple days ago, and I saw mums everywhere.
Everywhere, and they're beautiful.
And yeah, they are, but I always looked at them as annuals.
Me too.
I buy them a little later in the season, they're field-grown. They have the potential to be this semi-perennial.
You guys have the fantastic ability of asking very good questions. If they are field grown and like mine are grown in the field, they are not in our visible sight range from our house. We have to go around and back of the elevated planters that we have them behind and say, oh, they're going to be ready to transplant where we want. Mums are one of the easiest plants to go ahead and transplant. Take my word for it. You can go in there and dig them out, move them over to where you want, and bingo, they'll survive and thrive and do a very good job for you.
All right. The things we learn talking to horticulturist Ron Smith.
Well, you guys ask all the right questions.
Ron will be back on September 9th for our 3 o'clock show. That's when we're live, and he'll take listener calls at that time. So if you've got a particular question you want to ask an expert, September 9th, Main Street at 3 o'clock. Thanks for being with us, Ron.
It's a joy.
Dakota Date Book is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
In the late 90s, a group of musicians got together to try to answer a question.
What could happen when strangers meet?
The unexpected creativity that can come from working or playing or falling in love with someone very different from yourself. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 19th. In the heat of summer in 1885 at Fort Abraham Lincoln on the west bank of the Missouri River, Captain McCauley saw something he had never seen before. The river had spawned millions of mosquitoes, and their bites were so bad that Captain McCauley could only remain outdoors if he wore heavy riding boots, thick trousers, leather gauntlets, a head net, and a neckerchief tucked between his hat and shirt collar. But the day came when the mosquitoes disappeared, as if by magic. For out of the same river that spewed forth mosquitoes arose a species of dragonflies of rather large size that came in droves and cleared the place out. These dragonflies were the biggest dragonflies Captain McCauley had ever seen.
They had four wings, six legs, and were about 2 inches long, and were dark brown. The wings had a faint emerald green tinge. Captain McCauley was curious how they caught their food, so he observed a half dozen dragonflies as they flew about in a kind of irregular skirmish line. What he saw amazed him. The dragonfly wings shimmered and gleamed in the warm sunlight. These mosquito hawks were darting, flitting, swooping, zipping in and out, maneuvering to devour mosquitoes. At times hovering, at times moving swiftly sideways at bursts of up to 29 feet per second, the dragonflies would use their legs as a basket to capture insects. They would gobble the mosquitoes while flying. Each dragonfly had compound eyes, resembling beads, covering most of its head, capable of spying its prey 18 feet away and catching mosquitoes before the insects knew what hit them. It was on this date in 1890 that a newspaper story made mention of Captain Carter Nelson Berkeley McCauley of the U.S. Army and his experience among the dragonflies and mosquitoes of the Upper Missouri country. Captain McCauley served as a surgeon at Fort Lincoln for only a couple of years, but he long remembered the summer when excessive rainfall brought forth mosquito clouds from the river bottoms and how airborne dragonflies ate mosquitoes as their favorite food. McCauley was astonished, as we are today, by dragonflies, who swept through the humid air on iridescent wings, gliding up and down as mosquito hawks on the western plains. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, serving 3 million consumers in 9 states with electricity from wind, natural gas, coal, hydro, and nuclear. Basin Electric Power Cooperative, striving to be your trusted energy partner.
In the 1970s, a lawmaker in New Jersey proposed that residents put their glass, metal, and paper out on the curb in separate buckets. His neighbors thought his idea was garbage.
Did people dump a lot of trash on your lawn, or what was...
Just enough to irritate me, let's put it that way.
Today, recycling is big business. But is it getting too big? We go inside a sorting facility to find out on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Tuesday on Main Street, summer is coming to an end, and many schools in North Dakota will start classes this week. On Tuesday, we'll hear from Dr. Corey Steiner, superintendent of schools for the Northern Cass School District. Steiner is a passionate educator who says high-quality public education is a moral imperative. He spoke at July's TEDx Fargo. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.